was mining the clock, and we were at time, but I also had Rod's manuscript, and the ending was so good, I just couldn't bring myself to cut him short. So,
And I have to apologize, too, because some of this stuff I've already said in our thing, so
please forgive me. It was a great, great ending. Either of you care to jump in to get us started in our conversation?
You've marked yours up.
So I took notes, but it hasn't cohered yet. Do you want to start us?
No, you're welcome.
Oh, I see. All right. Putting me on the spot. Well, I found myself remembering what I believe it was Yaroslav Pelikan said, that, you know, tradition was the living faith of the dead, while traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. And I think your talk was a plea to find that life and the solidity that we need to get through, again, what you refer to as liquid modernity. And I'm reflecting on, you know, where do we find that? I think the diagnosis that I hear, the stories that you're telling in this talk are about a therapeutic culture, a culture that turns to feeling, emotivism. And, there's certainly plenty of feeling in medieval faith as well. But there are these solid places. How do you recover that? How do you build that into a culture that is so incredibly fragmented and fluid? I know your whole book is about that's the central question. Yeah,
yeah. I was talking again to Nora from the Bruderhof about economics and before this talk. Just now, and it was in our discussion, I was reflecting on how the basic economic structures of our society make community and permanence so difficult to achieve. And we can't just give up and say, well, we can't do this. We have to try to find some way to deal with the reality in which we're in. But I think it requires so much resolution on the part of individual Christians to stay put. And this is one of the hard lessons of my life, learning how to stay put, even when the going gets rough. I've failed at that in the past. But for me, even though I don't have Mont Saint-Michel in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, but I do have the Divine Liturgy, and I do have the Psalms and the Psalter, and I do have all these things in which the eternal, the presence of God speaks to me in sound and in form that way. And I think that only by doing it can it become real. When I became Orthodox 11 years ago, on the day we were received into the Orthodox Church, someone in the church came and said, "Congratulations, but don't think you've got it. It's going to take you 10 years to learn to think like an Orthodox." That didn't make any sense to me at all. 11 years on, I understand what they mean. And it really is true what Woody Allen said about life. It's true about orthodoxy. 90% of it is just showing up and allowing the structures of the liturgy and the practices to form you.
Yeah, I remember running across a book by Colleen Campbell years ago. You probably have seen it, The New Faithful, Why Young Adults Are Embracing Christian Orthodoxy. And she interviewed a young woman who had gone from, I think it was a Plymouth Brethren background, evangelical background, into a more liturgical church. And the gist, I don't remember the exact words, but the gist of it was, I'm not ready every day to walk into a sort of happy evangelical service. When I'm not there myself emotionally, I need something more structured. I need that framing of a liturgy to carry me during those times, and that was coming back to my mind as you were speaking.
You know, you say that, and you remind me of the vigil I kept with other family members at my father's deathbed 2 summers ago, and he died at home in home hospice. And as we knew that he was in his final days, one of my family members, who is a very devout evangelical, better Christian than I am for sure, came there and didn't know what to say, and she was grappling with, "Lord, we just want to, and the gravity of the moment overwhelmed her. Well, I didn't know what to say either, so I pulled out the Psalter and started reading the Psalms, and those words carried me, and they lent gravity and dignity and a sense of the sacred to this situation. And to judge her, but I could see that she just didn't have the emotions within her and the words adequate to the moment. But the Psalms said what we needed to say, I think, too, that for me, as I think I mentioned yesterday, my own return to Christianity as an adult began with by being smacked over the head by the wonder of the Chartres Cathedral. And wonder, is one, it occurs to me all the time because I could not resist it. I knew that there was a God behind the stones in this glass. And it was that encounter with wonder. This was my Damascus Road experience. And yet, most people who walk in that church don't have the same thing. So why did God speak to me that way, but everybody who walks out of there doesn't feel the need to begin the quest to get back, to quit being a tourist and to start being a pilgrim? How do you think that works?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, you were probably looking for solidity. There was something in you that wanted that. And when you found that in that incredibly impressive form, I think that probably spoke to you. I think that's, cliched as it is, it's an Enlightenment legacy to have all authority sucked into the self, to say that it's all back to reason or it's all back to experience leaves you completely unable to root yourself. And even seeing that in stone can kind of just, could hit you in that way. I'm guessing that it might have had something to do with that. I'm interpreting your experience.
But there was, Susan, also the preparation for it in you. You wrote about C.S. Lewis and how he said his conversion was too complicated to really write about. Because there were all these philosophical, theological steps he took before he had what we think of as his Damascus Road experience. But I really appreciate the work you're doing for the church and getting this conversation out there in the public square. I think it's very important, and I think it's important for the United States beyond even just the church, for people to start thinking about who they really are and what they want to be anchored in. And the fact that we are anchored in things even if we're not choosing them. We are engaged in habits whether we choose them or not. We're just blind to it. Mm-hmm. But this question of Mont Saint-Michel, what current symbols of sacred harmony exist today? You've mentioned the cathedrals and the sacred liturgy. I've been very influenced by Abraham Heschel, the great rabbi of World War II, saying that for the Jews, the Sabbath is the cathedral in time that neither the Romans nor the Nazis could destroy. That is very profound to me. And in all the Christian circles I'm in, Sabbath keeping is considered optional.
Yeah.
It's the only one of the Ten Commandments viewed as a suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
And so a number of years ago I started observing Sabbath, but it is individualistic. I'm not part of a Sabbath keeping community. So I have had to sort of discern what is Sabbath for me, but now it is Mont Saint-Michel. It is like sacred liturgy for me. It is something that you talk beautifully about the structure of the liturgy, like the walls of the cathedral. Well, Sabbath is that too. And that's something that the Jews have been able to do in the desert, in exile, in concentration camps, or perhaps even harder, in seasons of affluence and choice. And that's a gift to us.
Well, you know, I wonder, in listening to you talk, I wonder about the other things about society, about our culture today, that make it harder for us to find permanence. In other words, the belief that there is no given order, there is no sacred order, that it's all, that it doesn't matter. Matter doesn't matter. You know, I'm getting to the nominalism question here, but if you think about it, it really, once you start going down this path, it's amazing how this culture trains us to think that way and trains us to be blind to the presence of sacred order. And you think we don't have any buildings today that we see as sacred, maybe football stadiums, you know, but there we just aren't trained to see. What do you think? I mean, how can we regain that being trained to see and be, and have the confidence that Father Quintana had, that there is something to be seen, even though he can't see it right now, that there is a reality there that is simply veiled from him.
Yeah, I don't know. I do know. I blogged for a while. I have this Grateful to the Dead blog, and I'm not very active these days, but I know that statistically the stuff that gets hit the most is, I was asked years ago by Leadership Journal to do a piece on the Dark Night of the Soul. And I looked at it through the lens of Mother Teresa, very famously for 20 more or more years went through a Dark Night of the Soul, and C.S. Lewis from his Grief Observed, and Martin Luther, the Anfechtung and the perpetual kind of cycles of spiritual depression he went through. And it just struck me as you were speaking that if you do have a faith that is essentially emotivist, you have no foundation, you have nothing to fall back on when that emotion is removed. There's nothing there. And so I'm not even sure whether sort of beautiful buildings that would, you know, affect you emotionally is what we're talking about. It has to be something. It has to be a foundation that, as for Father Quintana, that actually weathers the loss of that. And that's again what made me think of the Colleen Campbell interview with the young woman who said, you know, I just need the liturgy to just kind of hold me. It's not an emotional thing. It's something that's deeper than that. Okay. And how we get back into there. I mean, I think of it as a re-narrating, and I think you used almost these words, a re-narrating ourselves into the Christian story somehow. But where does that happen well, and who does it well today? I'm not sure.
Well, as the Connerton said, it's not just retelling the story, it's reenacting the story.
It's the anamnesis.
Gosh, we've sort of talked ourselves into a hole, haven't we? Well, this is the question. And I think it's why we're here, one reason why we're here.
We sense that there's a solidity that is to be found in the tradition and in the past,
tradition,
that there's a life there.
Yeah. Have you read Hans Borsma's?
I love that book, and I've talked with Hans a couple times. Yeah, it's a great book.
And how is it received within Protestant circles?
I really don't know. It should be received. I do know that I discovered it through a review done by an art historian at Wheaton College named Matt Milliner. He's a very bright fellow. And it was a wonderful review. And I thought immediately both, I have to meet Matt Milliner and I have to read this book. So at least we have, you know, a Wheaton College professor, that's sort of a flagship evangelical institution, saying this is great, you got to read it. And of course Hans is at Regent as well, so which is another evangelical.
Yeah. Published it.
Yeah.
Everyone received the book and loved it and appreciates. Yeah. And he really understands the Orthodox tradition as well as the evangelical.
Yeah. Do you have any questions from the audience?
I have a comment.
Okay.
You know, Pietism arose as a reaction to the formalism of much of the spiritually dead magisterial traditions subsequently. But when you have the collapse of the structures of those traditions, then Pietism on its own becomes this formless emotivism, right? And that is the legacy of American evangelicalism. So it seems to me that what we're talking about is a quest and a common call to reclaim forms of life, whether they're private or public, religious or even out in the public square, forms that recapture the transcendent, right, in ways that are objective. One of the reasons I became an Anglican was because I was so exhausted from having to manufacture my own interior life, right? And I discovered in our tradition the prayer book, right? Here is a way of being. I discovered the Eucharist waiting for me when I showed up, right? I think this is what we're talking about. I think this is why this center exists, because Bob Weber discovered this, you know, 30 years ago.
But doesn't it go both ways, Joel, that if Pietism was parasitic in a way on the structures and the forms that were there, I mean, meaning that it depended on those being givens, that those structures and forms, the more liturgical aspects, depends on Pietism, on the sense of the renewal within the heart of the individual believer. That's why all those beautiful cathedrals are empty today in Europe.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, Weber can take us a long way on this discussion. Obviously, a form and spirit, you could say. Some have even gotten into a Trinitarian theology related to this kind of question, right? Of word and spirit, right? As being the essential engine of the Christian life and of human life. But I don't want to impose my own theology on the discussion. So, any other thoughts? I think it's appropriate now for us to open it up for either comments or questions from the audience.
So I'm here as a real live evangelical. I work as a campus pastor at Houghton, which is in Western New York College, very much like, I'm sure, like some of the schools you visited. Just wondering if you have any thoughts on the role of the Christian college in all of this. I mean, for me, it's, and I realize that as a campus pastor, everything, you know, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But I see a Christian college as a natural outlet for some of this monastic impulse within Christianity, a logical place to build some of the kinds of practices and a different approach to an interior life for students. I'm just, you know, as you visited these schools, have you seen schools that you say, oh, these could be places where some of this could be lived out? Or, you know, when I look at these schools, I see some that are I see a lot of potential, and then others that get locked in ridiculous evangelical infighting that will make this kind of thing impossible. So any thoughts on the role of the Christian college, evangelical college, in any of this?
Well, I can say just from my own experience visiting these colleges and talking to professors that there's some despair among the professors about the failure of the churches and the families and communities these kids come from. And I talked about this before. They come there with lots of enthusiasm, but nothing else. And something that really struck me that wouldn't have occurred to me, these professors saying that a lot of these kids come from broken families. And they don't know what it's like to be under, they come without fathers. They don't know what it's like to be under spiritual headship and under any kind of authority. They're suspicious of authority at the same time that they crave it. And these professors that who made the biggest impression on me talk about how they love these kids, but they only have them for 4 years, and they have to do their best to plant seeds and hope that they fall on fertile ground. But the mission of the church, it can't all be on, in the same way that we can't expect public school teachers to raise kids who come from families that are fragmented or non-existent, we can't expect college professors and campus ministers to suddenly start the work of formation that hasn't been done for 18 years. On the other hand, if they don't get it there, where are they going to be exposed to it?
I mean, I'm at a Chris. I don't know. I run a faith and vocation thing at Wheaton, and one of the things that I've noticed is that there's sort of two different ways that these students go wrong on vocation. And one of them is that they think that there's one mysterious vocation that's in God's mind. If they miss it, God's going to walk away from them and they'll be in deep trouble. And the other one is that they believe the Disney narrative, that vocation is primarily following your heart, finding the thing that jazzes you, and then living, being happy for the rest of your life because your vocation fits. And in neither of those do you get a real sense of vocation as a living and relational thing where God calls you and there are maybe other people involved in this, because what you're called to is actually to serve other people. So I think it's just individualism that's the problem. And you can get at it from many different ways. You can get at it through worship. You can get at it through talking about work and vocation, or through reading certain novels together as a school or what have you. But where you have that individualism that just fragments us and tears us apart and bows and just sort of goes along with the stream of that liquid modernity, then you're not. So I don't know if there's one solution. I agree that college should be a place where you could do that, and that there's all kinds of impediments to that. And then we could talk all day about, you know, where does the camel's nose go under that tent? Where can you find the place where you can begin to maybe narrate into a sense of implication into a larger relationship? On vocation, I like Steve Garber's book, Vision of Vocation, is very good for that, because he uses that term implication. How do we, you need self-awareness, but you also need self-transcendence, and that's the movement, whether you're talking about vocation or anything else. So I don't know if that's helpful.
I don't know much about Christian colleges, but I know the college students that we work with are seeking community and discipline in their faith. They are not very oriented towards church. Mm-hmm. They almost all grew up in churches, but they don't, as college students, feel welcome in most of the churches in town, even though a lot of the churches have college ministries. So, you know, culture is transmitted intergenerationally, and we have this very long gap now between when someone leaves the high school family church constellation and then is back to the point or is creating their own family. That is so long that the faith just doesn't get transmitted that whole length. And they tell me that they were sent to Sunday school classes, so they really don't know about being in an actual worship service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is something that strikes me as weird as someone who got serious about Christ as a Roman Catholic and then as Eastern Orthodox. We don't have children's church or Sunday school in that sense of as a substitute for the liturgy or the Mass. And I can't imagine why people would do that. Seriously, though, because this is where we're all supposed to be there together. I think, too, that I want to say something good that Christian colleges or ministries are doing. I write in the book about what's going on at UVA and other schools about the Christian Studies Center movement. And at UVA, the sort of constellation of houses, private houses that Christian students, same gender, live in community together. Some of them, they run themselves. Some of them have a rule of life to help them to pray more, to evangelize better, and so on and so forth. This is the sort of thing that I would have loved to have seen when I was in college. I wasn't a Christian in college. I was making my way through there. If I had seen that kind of community, I might have come to Christ sooner. It's also the case that when I was in college, this was the first time I ever had any exposure to history. As imperfect as it was and as fragmented as it was, I just never even thought about the history of the church between Acts and what we are today. When I encountered The Seven Story Mountain, Thomas Merton's book about his own conversion, that was powerful to me because it showed me not only a young man much like I was at the time, but it showed me the Christian tradition and Roman Catholicism, preconciliar Catholicism, that was just so unlike anything I saw around me. And knowing that it was once possible drew me in to the tradition and made me think, well, maybe if it was once like this, maybe it is like this somewhere else. But I think simply to be shown what is there. It's up to us to decide and the students to decide whether or not to pick it up. But just to let them know, you know what, it's not just all about praise choruses and the sort of trite pop Christianity that you see in so many Catholic and evangelical churches, but there's a lot more to it than that, and it's part of your inheritance too, it's part of the great tradition. St. Benedict is a saint from when the church was united, you know, and he is there for all of us.
Nora, did you want to ask a question?
Here we go. No, you ask the best questions, it's really do.
Thanks, Rod, for what you told yesterday and today. And I feel like what Rod has to say is what America needs to hear. And my question is sort of a big question, but it seems like since the beginning of Christianity, the devil has been trying to divide Christians throughout all Christianity, basically. And Jesus prayed to God that we may be one. And today in America, we all agree that something needs to happen and that we need to somehow break out of our individualism and our consumerism and that we're all called to do this. But I guess my question is, how do we do this, and what will it take for us to do this? Because you get to a certain point, and nobody's really willing to take that step of faith to break out of really what they've known.
Rich young rulerism is what you're talking about. Yeah, I think. I mean, don't you think that for me, I made the final decisive step for Christ as a young man in my 20s when I realized that I could not serve God on my own terms. It was either Christ or nothing. And for me, the big idol, the thing that I did not want to sacrifice was sexual freedom. Not that I made much use of it, but that was my right as an American. I wanted to keep my options open. But only when I realized, and God let me go as far as I could go, when I realized that was death. And that if I wanted to live, I needed to turn. That was my road to Damascus moment. But the road back, to switch the metaphor, the road back to Mont Saint-Michel, it starts with that bright light in the face. But you don't suddenly get there. You have to turn and walk all the way back. And I think that, as you say, the unwillingness to embrace suffering, it's something that affects us all, because we're all conditioned by this culture. I'm as guilty of it too. You know, Lord, make me chaste, but not just yet. You know, Lord, help me to be willing to bear suffering, but not just yet.
Well said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found myself wondering, where are the exemplars of suffering pilgrimage in our culture? We don't have many examples of that even in our arts these days. We used to, in literature and film. Scorsese's Silence really didn't get any attention, particularly. It was an attempt to show that possibility. I find myself wondering if, as a culture, we have lost respect for people who are so committed and care so much to some good that they are self-sacrificial.
Well, I want to say, too, something that was a really hard lesson I had to learn, and I think it tells us something about suffering and the way the church today faces it. And this is unusually personal, but I've written about this before, so I'm not telling stories out of school. I was so moved by the way my late sister bore her cancer, her fight with cancer, for 19 months down in Louisiana. She fought it with great faith and courage, never complained, was very, very stoic. And I was so moved by it that it helped make my wife and me, we made the decision to move back to live there. She died 6 years ago. But I learned as I was investigating her story that her stoicism was just that. It was terror. She denied that she was going to die. That was how my family dealt with it. She's not going to die. God's going to pull this out. Let's not talk about the possibility of death. So even though she was skin and bones from the cancer when she finally died suddenly, and I've seen over the last 6 years the effects of that. I thought she was willing to bear the suffering bravely, and she did. I don't want to take that away. But it was, in a way, it was a stoic form of bearing it, like I'm just going to keep going forward and not think about it. Because she didn't think about it, nobody in the family thought about it. They didn't talk about it with their kids. She and her husband never once talked about what happens if she dies. Even the night before she dropped dead, she told her best friend, "I think we need to have that talk." They never talked about it. And so he was left broken. They weren't prepared for the death. My parents weren't prepared for it. And I have seen the run-on effects, the ripple effects of that stoicism masquerading itself as Christianity, which is a very Southern thing. I've seen how that's affected and damaged the family, and even damaged the ability of some people who are around that to keep believing in God. So I did not really appreciate how, in my Southern culture, Christianity is really stoicism in many cases. Walker Percy wrote a great essay about it that I found later, long after my sister died, and suddenly it made sense to me. Again, I don't want to take away from the courage that she really did face, of the stiff upper lip, sense of duty, never complain, but it's not the same thing as being transformed by suffering. What's that?
It's not lament. I'm afraid, well, Greg, can you make it quick, or is it a long question?
No, it's not a long question. Come on. I can't guarantee how long the answer will be. But
Rod, I read your book a couple months ago. I wrote a short response to it over at Scriptorium Daily, a group blog site for the faculty of the institute I teach at. And I mentioned there that, in one sense, the Benedict option has been available for 1,500 years. It's called monasticism, and actually it's been available for 2,000 years. We've had monasticism in the church for 2,000 years, and yet here we are. So we've had people going off, and actually we've had people in numbers unheard of these days, to go and be separate from culture, yet here we still are. What makes you hopeful, more hopeful, that this Benedict option is somehow going to stem a tide that hasn't been able to be stopped anyway in the past 2,000 years? And I'm looking at history now as a cumulative, like we got here because of this, because of this, because of this, not like, I know you could say like, well, in 9th century Europe, monasticism flourished and saved civilization, except that civilization they saved is now on this decline. So just some thoughts about that to situate it in the larger monastic history.
Oh, that's a really good question. And I think the answer, I would say, to be brief about it, is you know, the church always has to be reformed. Maybe you've heard that. There's no such thing as perfect stability. There are no utopias. As soon as we get it right here, it goes wrong there. And I look to monasticism and just generally what it symbolizes as a constant call to reformation in particular ways. And secondly, though, I don't know that this is going to do what it takes, but I'll give you a Walker Percy answer. What else is there? I don't know what else to do. You know, I have kids of my own. I have skin in the game. I don't want to save the Imperium, shore up the Imperium. I want my descendants to bear witness to Christ, even if they have to do it unto death. But I see that there's so much in this culture around us that works against that, against forming authentic Christians. And I feel like we have to pose some kind of resistance some way, even though we have no guarantees. And partly too, as having, I've been interested in monasticism ever since I read Thomas Merton, you know, on my journey toward Christ. But having lived in the Orthodox Church and having seen in a way that I didn't live out as a Catholic, having seen how practices and how liturgy forms one's consciousness, it really made me feel a greater sense of urgency about how practical this sort of thing is. And of course, if you go to Norcia, and I spent time with those monks, and you see the light of Christ in them, and they'll tell you, this is not us, this is Jesus, and we have had to die to ourselves and do have to die to ourselves every single day in these practices. Well, again, we don't have to live those practices out. Those are monks, we're not. But the same, the rationale is the same. Dying to self so we can live in Christ is the only thing that's going to draw us in.
With that, we have to close our time. Let's thank our speaker and panelists.
The Ancient Evangelical Future Conference is hosted annually by the Robert E. Weber Center at Trinity School for Ministry. This recording is a production of Whitchurch Publishing, trusted resources from Trinity School for Ministry, all rights reserved. Visit us on the web at www.tsm.edu.